You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hi, Sam.
Hello, everybody. Hey, Robert. Welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Robert Gold. How are you doing today, Robert?
Could not be better up in the cold, frozen north of Toronto, Canada. However, we're in the middle of a January thaw, and we had rain. I should pick up my laptop and show you out my window. There's mounds of dirty snow at the parking lot, but it's kind of like spring here right now. So we're happy for a week. And then we're going down to pretty close to your kind of talk, 30, 28 degrees. It's going to be cold.
Yeah. Wow. No kidding. I think we're up to like 50 Fahrenheit here in Kansas City. Yeah, I checked it just exactly right. We got to do a quick conversion here. I'm not good at this, but that's 10 yeah. Centigrade.
My favorite is like 2022, which is 70, 74. That's my
absolute. Yes.
We don't get a lot of that here. We get cold, we get sticky heat, and we get some rain and some golf days. And, you know, I battery bike around downtown Toronto because I like to be on city streets, keeping up with the cars, with, you know, the torque improved bike. We've got a lot of bike lanes in Toronto. So I miss that because I'm a fair weather rider, Sam. I do not ride in the cold. I do not like that.
That's fair. That's fair. But also, yeah. So how many months do you get a month or two of riding? Much riding do you really get?
I go from May through October, early November, if it stays mild enough. Otherwise, I'm done by Halloween because it gets dark, right? The clock then changes and we get
dark fair.
Fairly early here.
Okay. Do you guys observe daylight savings time?
Oh, absolutely. We're on standard time now. It makes no sense to me. It should be permanent daylight savings time. This makes no sense. You can go back to the history of agriculture and farmers in both our countries, and we don't do that anymore. The farmers don't need to take, we need as city dwellers, primarily the population, is to have more light, not freaking less light. Makes no sense to me.
We're going to dive down this a little bit. To that end, I've always kind of wondered, I mean, from a historical perspective, couldn't the farmers just wake up an hour earlier? Like, what? No. And they're still waking up an hour earlier. We've just done them the courtesy of, like, we're all going to wake up on your behalf an hour early.
You know what? We talk about the farmers, and we might jump in. I might be jumping ahead a little bit. But when you look at over the last number of, say, decade and a half, the technology and the machinery that the farmers are using, they can get up when you and I get up to go to the office. The robots take care of everything on the farm now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about you, though. So you're the managing partner with Bennett Gold LLP, a CPA firm, obviously, in Toronto, Canada, which I love that we connected over LinkedIn. Andrew, fantastic guy, had him on the podcast already. You've got a history of creating over 700 podcasts.
You want to know how they started?
Shoot.
The first podcast I ever did was called the Mobile Movie Minute. Launched it in 2007 when Steve Jobs and Apple said, we're opening up iTunes to anybody that wants to make a podcast. I'd already been doing audio file distribution through our firm of short MP3s of video, of audio clips, business tips. So when all of a sudden I could do a podcast, my wife and I used to go to movies every Friday. And mm-hmm. I took a recorder. At that point, the mics and it was all different at that point. But effectively, we each had a lanyard mic, held it in our hands, saw a movie, all types of movies, every Friday for a long, long time. Took the handheld recorder, left the movie. We didn't talk about this after we got out of the movie, get out, didn't say a word, got in the car and talked about the movie. We called it the Mobile Movie Minute. We debated. We never agreed. We argued. We got emails from around the world, people telling us that they listened to it. And the way movies came out, they came out as a movie effectively in North America. Then they'll open another country. But then the DVD came out in North America. Then the DVDs open another country. And then it goes to like public air or something, you know, not YouTube then, but at least airs on broadcast. So there's three cycles of any movie. And so we would people would be a year or two behind us, and they'd be commenting to us by email on a podcast they listened to. Anyway, we did this. We rated them by bags of popcorn. Did we think they were any good? What kind of movie were they? Date flick, Boys Night Out, that older couple.
Then we
recommend who's it good for. And we made sure, my wife's name is Cindy. Cindy and I made sure we never freaking agreed. I mean, she might have wanted to agree, but then I would just take the other side. And it was hilarious. And they were short. We had Adam Curry. You know who Adam Curry is? The Podfather. He does the No Agenda podcast. He's the guy that originally invented the sharing of MP3 files. He did some jingles for us. His music guys did jingles for us. Maybe I'll find the jingle, send it to you. You can add it on to another show.
Anyway, wow. All right.
Then Andrew and I did the Business Cast podcast for hundreds of business interviews. We did them in a bagel restaurant in Toronto, moved to a Starbucks. We did the mobile. Then we went to a studio and did mainly phone interviews. And yeah, podcasting started in 2007. And here I am, I don't know, almost 20 years later, right? And now the only difference is I'm not in a bagel shop and I'm staring at Sam.
That's really exciting. Okay, I'm tempted to dive in on that, but I don't want to divest from, tell me about what you're doing currently with your CPA firm, because my guess is that's kind of your day job, so to speak,
yeah,
right? That pays the bills.
That's my 9-to-5 or whatever. So I'm the managing partner of a local firm of CPAs in Toronto, which means we're one office, we're a dozen people, we're 12 people, professional accountants, student accountants, admin people. And that really, we're a knowledge-based venture, right? We deal with data, and we're in the communication business. We try and communicate complex financial data to lay people, because that's exactly who the entrepreneur world is. So we cater to entrepreneurs, self-employed professionals like lawyers with the incorporated practices, dentists, chiropractors, all of that. But I'm also the entrepreneur in residence, they call me, at a university called Ontario Tech University. And my task there is to do online workshops to international entrepreneurs coming to Canada under what's called the Startup Visa Program. It's somewhat of a fast track, bring your venture here. However, with immigration cutbacks across North America, there's not as many coming, so I don't see I'm doing as many workshops, but yeah, that's so I counsel entrepreneurs, but as the managing partner of the firm, I manage the CPA from the business interests of the firm. I'm more the business development guy and come up with the how do we use the software correctly, and I have a partner that manages the assurance practice. I share the responsibility with the tax practice, but the fun that I have is meeting new entrepreneurs, bringing them in, helping them along, meeting new entrepreneurs. It's a personal cycle that I live. That's my routine, is the cycle of bringing in entrepreneurs, making sure the firm services them, get the bill out, get the money in, move on to the next entrepreneur, and consistently be available, because I'm the trust link to the firm until other firm members open up their own trustability. And that happens fairly quickly. Trust is transferable if in a professional services firm. You just have to live up to the, you know, the WOW service motto and, you know, be calm and professional. So yeah, that's what I do now. Yeah. That's what I do now.
I agree. Yeah. Had this whole fun conversation about transferable trust at one point. It's almost like a currency if it's done right. But one, it's interesting. We could dive into quickly if we wanted to, and I almost kind of want to if you're interested.
Yeah.
You're right that there's definitely been, it seems like, a lot of cutbacks. There's probably not been as much much migration going around in general, which is really upsetting, because in most cases, and you're welcome to correct me if I'm wrong, but in most cases, that just seems to be government overstep, and that's never good for business, is it? I mean, I'm not saying I'm a professional at business, but in my experience, people flowing around where they want to go, making what they want to make, where they want to make it, doing what they want to do, like, these are only things that the more we can open that up for anybody, anywhere, just kind of the better it is for at least business in general. I would think it would be better for governments too.
Well, you know, if you look at the government as a business, but to your main point, absolutely, labor pools should be fluid. People should be able to go where the market is for their, you know, unique service. And the unique service is not likely thousands of dishwashers coming in, but we do need thousands of educated engineers coming in. We have two large countries here. I mean, you know, the joke in Canada is, politics aside, the joke in Canada has always been that if the U.S. sneezes, Canada gets a cold. And that's the reality. You're our largest trading partner, and that's never going to change. We can redirect some of our resources and do all this other stuff, but come on, we share a border, and there's a lot of you, and there's not a lot of us. So it's in our interest, and it's in the interest of, say, India and China to allow their engineers to come here to service the end. Money always flows back home. I mean, I don't know what a lot of the fear, of course, is politics based. But if you look at the government as a business, they have to have the flow of resources as well, too. I imagine in both our countries, the union strongholds on government employees probably limits the number of immigrant skilled outsiders that can come in. Today's politics aside, that's probably always been an issue when there's a union controlling and safeguarding the membership. So, but if government allowed free flow of people as well, we'd all be better served. The bigger worry, though, is a lot of this free flow of liquidity of population. A lot of that's not going to be needed when agentic AI is doing government employee tasks. Because to me, that's the first place you start automating with agentic AI. Absolutely the first place. How many times are you on hold trying to get something from some government service or agency? It could be really quick. This is what I want to know. Beep, 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 beep. Here you are. Let the systems talk to the systems. It's, you know, a decade away, right? But so who needs this labor pool? That's the bigger issue that's being raised all the time anyway, isn't it? I know so many of our clients with university-age children in Canada and the U.S. that are graduating, and where's the job for today's university graduates? I found years ago when we started introducing software into our CPA firm, we didn't use less people, but everybody had more skills because the crap work was gone. Technology took the crap work. Well, that's now being elevated, so the non-crap work is going to be gone. Some of the skill set's going to be gone. And at some point, you run out of room to push people up, right?
Yes.
And I think that's suffering right now at the university graduate level. Like, that's what's not being pushed up. Everything else is tableauing, if you will. Although I saw that the U.S. added 50,000 jobs, according to whatever stat that was released today from whoever. Canada added jobs, but our unemployment rate went to 6.8%. And this is driven by, you know, the tariffs on our exports to our number one trading partner. Although most of our goods that go to the U.S. fall under the existing USMCA. But depending how the Supreme Court goes, and they're supposed to rule today, I didn't see anything. Maybe you did. If those tariffs get struck down, the worry is that Trump will just rip up the USMCA. And, you know, now there's no deal on the table. So who knows? But that's not what we're here to talk about. The answer will be soon, though, if they rule.
Right. Well, I don't know. It's interesting for me. I'm not going to pretend like these statistics don't have value, because I think they do. And this is a little bit more anecdotal. But for me, I've always kind of noticed, at least in the small business space, sometimes the worse the market appears to be, the better my personal business is. And I haven't quite figured out the exact metric as to why that just appeared. I don't know if it's just small business can pivot easily and I'm just plunging forward. And, you know, I mean, if you're small enough, one or two new accounts significantly change the needle, right? Versus big business, you know, they got to go add 100, 200, 300 accounts in a quarter. And, you know, there's the regression there. But the other interesting thing I've noticed too, at least for me, just counter interesting point to the metric of new jobs added. The last 3 months or so, I've had more people cold call or cold email for roles asking for open jobs, if I have any, than I've had in a while. Now, there could be, we're just becoming a more popular company. More people know us. They want to reach out. Again, anecdotal evidence. I don't know. People don't typically, at least in my experience, cold call or cold email for roles. unless things are getting...
You know, as a professional services firm, we get routinely, and you know, goes in ups and downs, resumes and applications from new graduates, people that aren't happy where they are, or their firms merging. A lot of the practitioners are older, so their firms are being bought out, and staff may not like where they are, but there's normally an application flow. However, I've been hiring over the last, since the beginning of the summer, hiring a couple of key people. And where there was pretty slim pickings up to the last 2 years or so, in the last year, I'm finding I'm having less, it's taking me less time to find the people to fill the skill set that I need. And I'm in a city of, I don't know, 3-4 million, I guess, the greater Toronto area is maybe 6 million. So I'm drawing from the biggest pool in the country, even though it may be smaller by Chinese standards, 12 million in a city and whatever there are where you are. I think we're bigger than you, but I'm drawing from a big pool, and it's only now started to loosen up. So I don't know what that says, but I think it implies to me that there's less need for the people I'm trying to hire because of consolidations in this profession and maybe some saturation. There's not as many clients to go around, but we don't have the growth that we used to have at every level. Canada, you guys might find this interesting. Canada lives, and I imagine the U.S. does as well, off the backs of the growth of small business. 70% of all people that are employed in Canada are employed by what you or I, under broad definitions, would call a small business. 70%, not with the banks, not with the oil companies, not with the telecoms, with small businesses. And if our small business and your small businesses, they're both consumer economies, if we can't keep them going with the flow of labor, proper tax policies, keeping them afloat, then this is really the weakness in both our economies. So luckily, both our economies have got a natural entrepreneur spirit. Entrepreneurship culture is in both Canada. I mean, it's the great American dream, right? It's as is the Canadian. It's all entrepreneurship and building your own thing, if you will. So my client base, to bring it back to that, is all those entrepreneurs from startup to long tail entrepreneurs.
So this is interesting. I mean, just I wanted to do a quick check because I was kind of curious. So it looks like the U.S., if we're trusting the Google agentic AI, or it's LLM, I guess, technically in this case, 45 to 46% of Americans are employed by small business. That's an interesting gap. It's about a 30% gap. 2025.
Use the same agent and ask the stat for Canada, and let's at least compare apples to apples in that database.
Okay, let's do it. No, I like this because it would seem to assume a more 46% according to the same
Canada.
Accounting for
so whether it's 46 or 70, it's still an equal base of the
it's still significant. Yeah, I would like it. I think we would probably both like it. I think it'd probably be better in the main if it was 70%.
Can we ask one more thing? Ask that same question about government employees.
Oh, well, okay, interesting. Percentage by government.
We'll
start with.
And let's get them.
Percentage employed
by government or government agencies. Yeah.
Okay, around 25% in Canada.
Yeah, in U.S.?
Yes. 10 to 11.
All right, so in both our models, we take those out and then look at the percentage of people employed by, say, Fortune 500s and small business. Take the U.S.
Interesting.
It's a huge percentage of the business-employed people.
Interesting. Okay, so, all right, now, not to throw you a curveball here, but to kind of get back, so... Let's kind of, all right, Robert, here's where you're at now, right? You own this firm, about 12 people. You've done over 700 podcasts is what you put here. Co-authored a number of books. This is the person you are now, but we're going to jump in a time machine, if you will. We're going to grab the proverbial dial and we're going to hit rewind. And we're going to go back to Robert Gold I like to pick kind of the high school days. Like the 16, 17, 18, in my mind, this is the period when it's like, you're getting out of high school at some point or another, you're starting to move out of the parents' house. What are you going to do? What's going through Robert's mind right now? Where is he? Is he in Toronto? And what is it you're going to do with your life? Do you know what you're going to go to college for?
Here's the path. Here's the path. I came out of high school and went to university with no real inclination, took psychology and sociology, 3 years, part of the best 3 years of my life. It was easy. I could talk. I could write essays. I was with a friend of mine writing essays for other people in other schools. As kind of like, you need an essay written on something? Sure, we'll write it, $45. Myself and my buddy John traded a high school teacher was working on his BA at University of Toronto or some school. And John and I wrote this essay in exchange for a ride with him down to Florida, where my girlfriend was with her family. We got a ride down, and we theoretically were going to ride back with this guy in exchange for writing a first year or second year university essay for him. So I went through that kind of vacation and then got serious. And
that's quite a road trip.
Yeah, yeah. But in first year university, I met the person who had become the first Mrs. Gold. And when I met her, she was a language student. We went on to stay together through undergrad. She went on to be an Air Canada flight attendant. I went into the MBA program in graduate school, and we stayed in graduate student residences at York University. We made that decision. Side story, my father was a CPA in Toronto with a small practice. And he used to say, I have two younger brothers. He used to say to me, the only two things in life are true. Two things in life are true. Death and taxes, and you don't want to be an undertaker. So he had a small practice running out of our house. He'd had a larger practice, but through some business decisions, scaled down, had his business office in our house. My mother was his secretary at the time. My brothers and I would assist him with paperwork, bookkeeping while we were teenagers in the house. He's got a grounded education. My middle brother followed the same career path as I did, CPA. The youngest one's a veterinarian. So go figure. So I remember saying to my dad that I've decided to go into the MBA program and get my public accountant's license, get my CPA, and Bonnie, girlfriend at the time, and I are going to get married. So I kind of tied the two things together because it kind of made sense to me. And that's what happened. I went on, got a job at a national firm, was at KPMG. Bonnie went on to be a flight attendant, and while I was at KPMG, graduated with my CPA with a plan to get my trustee in bankruptcy as a professional. My middle brother was at another firm in downtown Toronto. He was going to get his public practice license. We're going to join my dad, and we're going to have this firm that did trustee stuff because I could see a future in consumer and small business bankruptcies. My brother and my dad would do the accounting stuff, the tax return, and that's what we would do. And that was the plan. And I had my license before my brother, and my dad died right at that stage. So I was at KPMG. My brother still hadn't passed his final CPA exams. We're going to join up with my dad, and now he's dead. He was 51, died at 51. So I left KPMG, took over his small business practice in the basement.
How old were you? Because that seems pretty young, 51.
26.
Okay.
I was 26. Moved his practice after introducing myself to his clients, most of whom I known from those days back in high school, which frankly weren't that far behind, right? He still had
a
client base, and I could talk the language, and nobody likes to change accountants, that's for sure. So anyway, I moved the practice out of my mother's house, took on my dad's one employee, and within a 3-year window, had met and merged with a smaller with a two-partner downtown firm, and we did a deal. So I moved my local practice from the north end of the city with one employee and one type as bookkeeper to a couple of guys downtown, 20 years older than me. So I was 29 at that point, and Donald and Harry are their names. They were 49. They were 49. Moved my practice.
And I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off too much, but I'm trying to kind of lock in. Are you just responding? I mean, don't get me wrong. I think you're probably doing a very good job responding, but that's such a emotional turmoil of like, okay, dad passed away. I'm taking on his firm. Like, that's a very significant decision, which is essentially what you made, right? You know, I'm going to call the clients and sort that out.
You know what, Sam? I didn't have a second's hesitation.
Okay.
A second. I was going to leave KPMG because there's no way I was going to be accountable to people my whole freaking life. I don't care how far up. I was there. I saw how it worked. Everybody up the chain is accountable. And I was never going to be the guy at the top. And I didn't want to be the guy running Toronto reportable to international. So it was no question in my mind. My dad's passed away. I only have one choice, and that's it's now or never. KPMG were terrific. I had good relationships there. I was there quite young, right? I was there mid-20s to 26. And they said to me, look, you can stay. We'll help you sell the practice. If you grow it and you want to talk to us about merging in, we're open to that conversation. So none of those things happened, of course. I went my own way. But I maintained lifelong relationships with some people there that I still see fairly routinely, not to do business, but, you know, now I've got long-term social, a couple of them from there. But there was no, I had no hesitation. Take over the practice. Now, it meant that I couldn't pursue my trustee thinking of trusteeship because at KPMG, before this happened, they were career pathing me. I was one of their superstars. And they said, if you do this and this, we can do this. I said, you know what? I don't want to do that. I want to do this because I saw a future with trusteeship. But just like I got my CPA under their umbrella, I get my trusteeship under their umbrella, then go join my brother and my father. My brother will have passed by then. I'll be, you know, 30, maybe not that. My brother would be there. Anyway, that was the plan, right? They were going to train me to be a trustee, and I was going to set up the small number of offices of consumer small business bankruptcy services because you can automate that pretty easily. Anyway, none of that came to pass. So my brother stayed where he was. It was the emotional of it, to get back to your question. The emotional was, you know, my dad died. He was 51. I was 26. My mother was his typist. My brothers and I have to think about her, deal with whatever my dad's estate was, and quite frankly, wasn't much. So take my mother on as kind of the payroll of the business because my dad had her on, and take on his staff and see what we can do.
She was the one employee.
An accountant, a junior accountant, who went on
to his
own practice. He and I got along great. He was a younger guy. But what's, there was a thought that was in my head, but it escaped me. Oh, I know. The client communication, early on, I learned at my dad's knee, if you will, through a teenager, watching him run this accounting practice from home, not learning the skills of debits and credits, which he tried to drum into my head. It's like tedious stuff when you're a teenager, but I could learn to do the bookkeeping that he taught me. It's kind of a rote function. He paid me $10 an hour or something. So I was, you know, working and learning, I guess, but I saw how he interacted with clients and he could communicate with anybody at any level. He used to say to me, the key is to communicate with them. Get down to their level. He always felt he could speak to anybody. Get down to their level and just, like, you know, speak to people honestly. And that's been like my mantra. You have to communicate at that level. So I went, I knew this instinctively, learned it already from my dad. So I went to his clients and effectively said, this is what my dad did for you. I'm taking over his practice. I hope he'll stay. I mean, quite frankly, Sam, they didn't really have a choice because we were, you know, just let's carry on.
For
a year. If you can do it, you can do it. If you screw it up, you know, I'll go elsewhere. I have to go elsewhere anyway. So, but I said to them, you paid my dad, or you'll now pay me, as I outline the service, too much for what we do and not enough for what we should be doing. Because my dad was running a little bookkeeping, accounting, tax practice. He worked with people on a fixed fee. And for, say, $900 a year, or maybe today's dollar, $3,000 a year, he would make sure your bookkeeping was done. This was manual books back then. Bookkeeping was done. T4s were done. Your personal tax return was done. Corporation tax return was done. Corporation financial statement. All of that for $3,000 a year. I would say that's ridiculous. I'm not doing anything fixed fee. We'll contract out the bookkeeping part of it and introduce you to a bookkeeper. And bookkeepers can do what they can do, and we will take on and only keep the professional accounting stuff, and your fees to us will be the same, but we're getting rid of the stuff that we should not be doing. And they all said, okay, as long as it's, you know, seems affordable, we get the results at the end of the year. Didn't lose any clients. And within a year, you know, you start to, I didn't have an otherwise business network except this package, right? That I inherited, if you will. So once I saw that we could do the work and we delivered, then I started making my own network connections. They started referring family members. You know what I learned? When it comes to accounting services and tax services, our phones used to ring more on Monday. Now, you know, email communication, hey, so-and-so. People talk about how much tax they pay at parties on the weekend, and they get referrals, say, hey, you should call my guy. And then on Monday, Sam Sapp calling, you know, Andrew Brown said I should talk to you. He loves how you do his taxes or whatever. I understand you speak entrepreneurship. My accountant doesn't understand me, never returns my call. Andrew says you're always there. Mondays and Tuesdays, because these conversations come up at gatherings. People always complain about business and taxes if they have businesses or small businesses. We all do. The complexity of it is my complaint. I'd like to see both our countries just find a way to do a flat rate tax and get on with it. Problem is taxes implement government policies, right? Government policies through the tax system, which, I mean, either government says, oh, here's our new budget. Those changes are 3 years down the road by the time they affect the economy. It's all just hyperbole in media, right? It's all selling. Every government budget is selling. We live in the real world anyway. I don't know how we got into that topic. But
no, it's okay. I would love to talk to flat tax for a second, honestly, because I used to be, you know, it's like, it's one of those things where when you first hear about it, you're like, of course, why not? It sounds, and then you're like, well, but it favors the rich and da, 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 da. I want to, because hopefully Toronto is nothing like this, but I'm going to pick on Kansas City for a bit of a second. So if I were a full-time employee, I would pay federal income tax to the United States government, the IRS. I'm also then going to pay Missouri income tax. Missouri collects income tax. Then I'm in a local county. My county for the state of Missouri, as well as for the local county, is going to charge me annual taxes in December, by the way, right before Christmas, associated with the value of the property I own, property tax. Finally, I'm going to be taxed by Kansas City itself, who also collects income tax. By the way, I have not discussed sales tax at all yet, which would be its own separate thing. What I think a lot of people that don't like the notion of a flat tax miss, that I've only recently been thinking more about, is the quantity of employment fat, for lack of any better term, and paperwork fat and operational fat associated with. And when I say fat, I mean, if you had one flat tax at, gosh, I don't know, 30% across everywhere, you would have all these rules and laws, and you would slim right. everything down such that everyone would make more money
for
less work.
Exactly. And look at the administration costs that are like out the window. Enforcement costs are significantly less. And the other thing, you know, there's a lot of mechanics to this. They have to make the exemption level for singles and families fairly high. The combination of this with, and this is really unpopular with people that have this, is a wealth tax. Because the thing that bothers me about Western economies, and I benefit from this, but it's wrong, is that passive income is taxed cheaply. And hardcore labor income, you and I working, my people that work, guys in the farms, employment income, self-employed income is taxed higher than passive income. Should be the other way around. It's the employees that are driving the economy. It's not the payment of dividends to people that only, it's just, I mean, look at Jeff Bezos. You can't not have a curve like that when all the money's doing is making money, sitting on his ass, right? Firing rocket ships. The money's making money, and what's it contributing to? It's being, in theory, it's being loaned into the economy. This is Reaganomics, right? The trickle-down effect. Well, it doesn't work. It doesn't trickle. It gets hoarded. It gets invested out of the country. It's like, it's bullshit. It makes no sense to me. So a wealth tax or switch that dichotomy of employment income, self-employment income, tax less than passive income, I benefit from all of that thing. Capital gains, I could argue why I don't want capital gains tax rates raised because it's cheap in Canada. Only half of the gain is taxable. I could argue forever why that shouldn't be raised. And I could argue that on behalf of my clients. In reality, that doesn't fit the model I think it should be. Capital gains should be taxed at the regular income rate and give me a break on my self-employed income and you on your employment income, whatever it might be. Somebody show me the numbers that tells me this is a bad idea.
I would, and I'm curious. I've had, that's a fine notion. Yes. I've also been playing with the idea. It's a little bit the opposite of what a lot of people talk about, but I've almost been kind of playing with the notion of like, what happens if all we had was a property tax? Which sounds weird because I know a lot of people are like, I don't want to be taxed on my property. But I'm kind of over here like, look, if you go out and buy a big mansion valued at a lot of money, and this works for 2026, where cryptocurrency, for the most part, I mean, you've got some fancy currencies out there that you can duck all the money you want into. If you buy a big mansion, we can see the mansion. We know what that the mansion is there. We know that the mansion is yours. We know that the mansion is worth X amount of money. We're going to tax you on the ownership of the mansion. Now, there's the argument to be made, well, people just won't buy mansions. It's like, okay, that's cool. Now they've got a ton of money. Like, I don't know, eventually you're going to have to do something with the money. It's going to either die or go to somebody else, or it's going to get back into the economy, hopefully would be the ideal scenario. But then, look, if you have a modest, I own one car, one home, we're just getting by, cool. That's pretty obvious and apparent to everybody. We'll tax you on that. I have a massive mansion, and again, it comes back to if you have cryptocurrency, it's just all about the quantity of land within the country that you're in is what you own. That's what you're taxed on. I'm curious your thoughts.
First of all, go back to one of your first comments. All those levels of tax you have, we have all of those except the city of Toronto, although it assesses property taxes, as do you, we don't have city income tax. We've got everything else, federal, provincial, we got the same sales tax issues, however it's built into the economy, but we don't have city income tax. And our tax return filing systems, I think, is a little more simple than yours from what I've observed. Not saying that it's cheaper, but it's a bit of a simpler process, it seems to me. And I think that CRA, which is our IRS, Canada Revenue Agency, seems to me to be more responsive to communications, not tomorrow, but somewhere within in Canada, they go on a 6 to 8 month window on some things. The IRS, when I've been dealing with them or have been party to communication with them, 12, 14, 18 months. How does that make any sense? This is where the agentic AIs come in, right?
Yeah.
So you've taken on
your father's business. You were already planning on joining the business. You already had these. I'm kind of trying to put myself mentally in your shoes. Yeah. You already had these notions of, maybe these are the changes I might make if when allowed. And so you kind of, Monday morning, so to speak, a little bit ready to go. You're like, all right, it's go time now. Mom's got to get taken care of. That one employee needs to get taken care of. Those clients need to get taken care of. You need to eat. But to your credit, I find this fascinating. That just goes to show, I'm guessing, the business acumen that your father gave you, plus the fact that you were thinking about it. You are immediately making the changes with regards to like, hey, you're professionally talking through these are the new rates and this is the new service. And you're doing that in the transition rather than what I feel like most people logic away. It's like, oh, well, I'll do that later. But then they never do.
Then they never do, or something fails. No, because this is personal service, my relationship with Sam is ongoing. It's not like, oh, it's in the mail, got screwed up in manufacturing, Amazon lost it. No, I'm dealing with you at this time over the phone. I had one of the first in Canada devices, answering machines with a button I could press to record the call. The guy that I bought the machine from was a telephone mechanic from somewhere in East Europe, and he just fixed the box. He fixed the answering machine box. Box was called Record a Call. I think it was called Record a Call, even though it recorded the call, but didn't have, it was answering machine only. Record a call.
Okay.
Only, but no record for voice calls. Like, we could not do this. So my guy put the button in. He said, but don't tell anybody. I don't think it's legal. I have no idea. Now, if you record somebody on your phone, the voice comes on, the call's being recorded. Who knows what the protocols are supposed to be?
This is probably even before the laws were written in the same sort of way, I imagine, maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
So I don't know how we got to that, but.
No, that's okay. That's interesting. So then you're saying within 2 years, you're merging with another company, yet another.
Within three. Within 3 years. Shortly after my dad died, and I'm still working in to give you the picture, my dad used to describe his office. He had a den in our house. It was a side split. He had a den. That's where he would meet clients.
Okay.
And in the back, go around a little hallway, in the back, he would say that his office is between the furnace and the dryer, and it was. In the basement of the house, there was the furnace, there was a washer and dryer, behind him was the freezer, here was his desk with two windows that looked into our backyard, and he eventually made the backyard, he put in an above-ground swimming pool, and he took off every summer. He died young, but he took off every summer and hung out at his pool, but his office was between, well, I couldn't work like that, I was at KPMG, right? I knew what a professional office was. My dad had that, but decided to, you know, change his structure.
Sure.
So I wasn't long before I negotiated my first lease. It was a confusing adventure. I was 26, right? But anyway, it worked out okay, got a good space, and then start to grow the practice of my own networks. And the employees stayed with me and eventually changed that employee. And so I'm sorry, I went a bit off track. So within a couple of weeks of working between the furnace and the washing machine,
sure.
Dad's desk, I get a phone call from a fellow named Donald Bennett. My firm is
okay.
Bennett Gold. Donald Bennett was my dad's age, and he came called looking for my dad. He was another CPA in Toronto, and they shared some colorful clients, is probably the best way to put it. So Don called up looking for my dad. I answered. I told him my dad had passed away. Took him completely by surprise. Said, I can't talk right now. I'll call you back. He eventually called me back. We met for lunch at a place called Sherlock's on Shepherd in downtown Toronto. Sherlock's the name of the restaurant. Shepherd Street was where Sherlock's on Shepherd. Of course, now it's a parking lot. But anyway, we met and we got along. I was now 29. He was 49. And he said, well, let's do a deal. I said, okay, in 3 years. I said, I got to see what I can do with this on my own for 3 years. I'll stay in touch with you. He said, great. We did stay in touch. And then when it was time to do a deal, I said to him, I have a big belief in computerized accounting. Right now, we weren't at that stage. Remember, it's the 70s. I said, here's what I want to do. I want to buy this piece of equipment, this kind of software. I want to offer computerized accounting, meaning bookkeeping, to our clients. This is how much I want to offer to them for. This is why I think we can work this way and really elevate our game. And he said, great. So based on that, we did our deal. Oh, the other thing was that my brother, who was at another firm, had to be able to join us because I was building on my dad's practice, right? Even though there was a financial arrangement for me to acquire it, I was still building on his practice. But I wanted to leave that opening for my middle brother. They said, sure. So we got together. I got my computer equipment, hired a girl to run the computer. My brother joined us. All went well. And then it was 1980, this massive recession in 1980. Interest rates went crazy, and clients couldn't afford the fees we needed to make this computer service run efficiently. It was hundreds of dollars a month. So after a few years, we walked away from our investment. We let the girl go that was running the equipment. Interestingly, she was, we went through a couple employees there. One of the women was a professional softball player and played for the Australian national team. And when she wasn't playing, she was a keyboard person for me. She had big arms, man. It was so funny to work with someone like that. Anyway, so we got out of the computerized accounting business and we carried on. We had a couple of other partners at the time.
So one second, let's discuss computerized accounting, if you don't mind, because this is like, I mean, and this is before my time. I don't know if I fully understand exactly what you're saying. My guess is you're discussing a world of like, well, this is before QuickBooks. This is before the internet. You know, we're providing the books in a more controlled digital format that people didn't have before. Is that?
We're computerizing what my dad's practice was, which was his manual bookkeeping, and then move on to the greater products, tax products and financial statements, right? We're computerizing that, keeping it in-house. And the goal was we'd run it all. We'd get the data we needed from the client. It wasn't QuickBooks. We got in checks, financial checks and bank statements and all the stuff that people upload to HubSpot or we would enter it. We didn't even have scanners, right? Somebody would enter it in. We would then produce monthly financial statements, income statement, balance sheets, some other stuff, so that my partners and I, with the terminals,
okay,
water on our desk, could call up the client within weeks after a month end and say, "I've got your November 30th financial statement with me. It's time to have that, you know, that monthly discussion." That was part of the fee package, and we would have more up-to-date financial data to talk with our small business clients than anybody, because nobody was doing what we were doing. Nobody could see it. Nobody wanted to spend the money on it. The practitioner.
I'm realizing how significant, surely, that would have been at the time. I mean, the recession you're talking about, I'm mentally living in a world where your clients know faster than anyone else that things are going south because they have last month's financials and everybody else is still kind of eyeballing it.
It's like everybody was negative QuickBooks. Right now, QuickBooks Online, I mean, it's an easy package for entrepreneurs to know how to produce their own income statement. We meet with our clients routinely to provide that service. But now it's so easy, right? It's push button and you've got the data. None of that existed anyway. So this recession hit. We had $100,000 at the time invested in this thing because we were losing money, because you had to build the business. You had to sell it to clients, right?
Right.
So they're not used to
this. Startup. Thing. Yeah.
Anyway, interest rates went up to like 19% or some goddamn rate. And we got out of the business. We were financing the loss. We sold off the equipment. And we sold off the equipment at that time and then bought one of the first IBM PCs that made it into Canada when IBM was trying to sell PCs. And we computerized our own internal operations. And we had a couple of, do you remember the computer company Compaq, Compaq?
Yep. I do.
Acquired by HP, I believe. They were big, and they had what we call luggables, at a small screen, like the original Macs, of course, had like the 9-inch screen. These are small green screens, but it was a self-contained unit, and we were taking those out into the field, and we were starting to automate a lot of our, you know, file preparation. It was all a paper-based industry up until that point in the 80s. So we took that. I personally took that technology stream early on. As an adjunct to that, if we jump ahead, just because it kind of fits in, and the turn of the century. In the year 2000, 1999, the internet became the public internet, right? Used to be in bookstores. We have a lot of large bookstores in Toronto. You go to one, there'd be a little section on the internet. You knew that it was a technical thing. The military was doing it. You'll flip open the books and it's all code and crap, right? But then the internet became public and the first Netscape came out and the first ones before Netscape. I was like one of those guys that had the first browsers. Watch Mark Andreessen when he was at Illinois University, whatever the, you know, and all of a sudden Mozart code was coming out, if I remember correctly. Anyway, it became Netscape and it became the internet. And I remember when that stuff started to happen, oh man, I lost my train of thought on that.
That's okay. Digital accounting, the Compaq before everybody else.
Yeah. Okay. So I remember now. So internet commerce was becoming a thing, and the CPA profession in 1999 decided that it wanted to be the known entity of assurance on the internet, so business could trust. Business consumers could trust business transactions, like buying from Amazon, and businesses could trust B2B transactions, me dealing with your company or me dealing with like Home Depot or something, a business account. So CPA profession in Canada and the United States created what was called Web Trust, and a business, a more technical side of it, SysTrust. Web Trust resulted in an audit by a licensed CPA practitioner or firm of the privacy and security and technical aspects of your website, so that we could effectively do an audit of the soft skills, the HR.
Yes.
In the technical controls, and issue a Web Trust seal on the site. And there was an
actual,
was covered. When somebody clicked on the seal, and it said, click on seal. When somebody clicked on the seal, they got to see the audit report of the site, got to see management's assertions of the controls, our commentary, they've done this. We've audited against their assertions. Here they are. And the privacy policies are posted. And that, so we established this Web Trust practice. In Canada, the national firms like PwC and EY and KPMG, and Deloitte's, they were the guys that got the licenses, and me as a small firm practitioner, because I was talking the talk already. This was easy for me. We announced as a local firm, when Web Trust became like a thing, it's now a legit thing that's being promoted. We announced that day in Toronto's largest business newspaper, the Globe and Mail. We took like earlugs in the financial section. An earlug is like the thing up in the corner, an ad. And we announced our Web Trust clients on day one. The one that you would be most happy to hear about is RocketRoger.com. Roger Clemens, one of the great baseball players with a colored story, was a pitcher for the Blue Jays at the time, and he won the Cy Young Award. Anyway, he was one of our Web Trust clients because they were selling stuff at RocketRoger.com. And so we certified the privacy and security on that site. And that gave us an opportunity to ultimately sell that service to PwC in Tampa, Florida. They didn't want another one of their competitors, Deloitte or KPMG, certifying their data center. So they asked us.
Gotcha.
They asked us if I could do it. I'm not a competitor, but they wanted a U.S. firm to sign off the audit report. So I brought in a partner firm, small firm like us, at a technology skill that I'd met at a Web Trust conference at Disney World. And we brought him in as the firm to sign off. They did the technical audit. I did the soft skills audit because that's where I'm stronger. And we did this work for PwC because they didn't want to give it to their competitors. They gave it to a local guy because it's non-competitive and a skill set that's licensed, right? So
this sounds like a SOC audit before SOC audits. SOC 1, 2.
It was just before that. They became...
Okay.
So the interesting thing about Web Trust and why it's not like a thing now, as the internet grew rapidly and consumer trust evolved quickly and things like eBay and Amazon, it just became more of a thing where finally your mother would shop online. Web Trust became more of a internal management set of criterias and principles that management internally in larger organizations could do this themselves to double check. And most of that work eventually got contracted out to systems people. You know, it kind of... The trust is there, right? It was never supposed to be forever, I don't think, because it's like using the telephone. You used to have party lines. You have to be comfortable with the party. Trust evolves, as we said earlier, right? Trust transferable.
But agreed. But it's also interesting, too. So what I'm hearing is, I mean, there were basically, you know, in the days before SOC audits, this was the SOC audit, and there was five companies that could do it, and yours was one of them.
In Canada, yeah. In the U.S., there was more of it. It's a bigger country. But there was not 20.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, in the Forbes top 10 companies doing SOC audits, there's these massive companies and you, which is fantastic firm.
Do you want to hear one other short story about that? What's humorous about accountants and technology? So when the AICPA, and which is the American Institute of CPAs, and CPA Canada, which under the name was the Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants, now it's CPA Canada. when they announced the service, so I can speak only to Toronto, they held a series of in-person sessions to launch WebTrust. We see it as the next big thing. We want the accountant, the professional accounting community, to be the arbiters of what you can trust online. Here's the principles, criteria. So I went to the session. I went through the demo website. I looked at the whole thing. It was rudimentary, but they told you what it was. They painted a picture. The public could more or less click on the public side and understand what it was. Probably 200 people in the room where they're giving this in Toronto launch of WebTrust. How many people have heard of it? A lot of hands went up. How many people have been through the website? You know how many hands went up? One. Mine. None of these guys who are there for this launch of this technology service bother to spend any time on seeing what it is. Not saying, yeah, I understand the concept, but let's look at it. Anyway, I could tell you one last piece. As a result of that, we became known for it. We offered our services to other local firms of CPAs in Toronto saying, we won't steal the financial or tax work, but we'll help you identify this WebTrust opportunity. We'll pay you a 20% commission or something, and we'll continue to expand our WebTrust service. So That was kind of interesting to offer that service to other firms because they're my direct competitors otherwise, right?
That's fantastic. So, okay, man, I'm trying to pick it up. So it's always been Bennett Gold, basically, right? Well, I mean, it was you 3 years, which that's a cool notion. Also, I feel like I don't know. These are just mature concepts that I don't, you know, early 20s, and maybe I'm just different early 20s, I guess. But, you know, you're telling the other guy too, like, let's do 3 years, and which is a smart thing because he's now invested enough to, like, not to say he wouldn't have given advice otherwise. I'm sure he probably would have. But now also, like, maybe if I'm him, maybe I'm a little bit more eager to pick up the phone because it's kind of like, yeah, we're probably going to end up working together anyway.
I used him as a bit of a, when I needed some professional advice, not tax, but say ethics advice, because I'm fairly new to public practice and, you know, ethics are, you know, they can be fluid too. So we had a client that was a travel agency and there was something amiss with it. They had to contribute or keep a trust fund or something. And there was some nonsense going on. So I called up Donald Bennett, and I said, we weren't partners at that time. We were just, so I used him as counsel. I said, here's what's going on, and described it to him. He said, there's only one thing you have to remember is the only thing that's important is your name. And if you're not comfortable with what might come up or what they're doing, walk away. Tell them why you're walking away, give them the solution, and just walk away. So that's another one of these things you never forget. All you have is your name, right? And in the going back to our trust and professional advice, people better trust us, right? They better think that. So when he and I got together, there was another partner. So I went from Robert Gold to Armel Bennett Gold. We added, and Watson. There was two other guys, Armel Bennett Gold and Watson. We added another guy named Berg. So we became Armel Bennett Gold, Berg, and Watson. We had an issue with Berg with the quality of his work. So he said to me one day, well, he was 20 years older than me as well. He said, I'm going on vacation. If you want to fix that job before it goes out the door, go ahead. I'm out the door. So it had to go out the door. It was one of his clients, but we weren't going to let the client fail or our filing. It's the firm, right? I finished the work, made sure we got it done, took care of it. When he came back from vacation, we parted company because that's no good. It's a partner, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we parted company. He sublet some space from us for a while, and then that was the end of that. The other guy, Watson, he became, we moved to a new office space, and one weekend, Donald, Harry, and I come in, and Glenn had moved out over the weekend. He joined another guy, but of a sleazeball CPA at the north end of the city, and Glenn was gone, sticking us with the lease, effectively, his share of the lease. So one of the partners, the Armel part of the partner, hated the Watson for having done that. I mean, it's poor move, but like, let's talk and let's get out of this. Let's figure out the lease issue. I understand you don't want to be here, but you are on the lease. So Harry immediately sued Glenn. Now we're in a lawsuit against the former partner, and we're spending money on legal fees And Donald.
So you guys decide you want to talk about it. And instead of Watson, I think was the name, instead of responding, let's talk about it, immediately goes into a lawsuit.
The other guy, my existing partner, okay. Harry Donald Robert. Harry said, I hate that guy. I'm going to sue him. So he started a lawsuit against him. Two other things are going on. Donald and I don't like Harry. And Harry's a bully, and he's the managing partner, and I'm 20 years younger than him, and it's a third, so there's not much I can do. Donald didn't want to go up directly against Harry and start any form of confrontation. So Donald and I were seeking counsel and had meetings with a firm advisor and a lawyer about how do we separate ourselves from Harry and not, get killed, right, and save the client base. And so we had a plan, and Harry went to Egypt with his girlfriend on a vacation. And Don and I, once he comes back, we're prepared to sit down and say, Harry, we're going our separate ways. Here's who our lawyers are. Talk to your lawyers. Here's our proposal. And you can stay here if you want, and we'll just charge you rent and all this other stuff. Harry comes back from Egypt, sick with the flu. And Harry dies. So now Donald and I don't have to go through with this plan. Harry did one really good thing. He lived up to what he and Donald had done for each other in their wills a number of years earlier. And they left each other their practice. Harry dies. Donald inherits his practice. Donald and I get along great because we were the ones that started the communication, right? Years earlier. So now Donald's got 2/3 of the practice. I've got 1/3 of the practice, and we move on. And over time, as the practice, Donald's 20 years older than me. So he's starting to wind down. I'm growing. I'm managing the office. Donald's leaving me alone to do what I want. So we end up in me having about, 60 to 70 and him having, 30 or 40%. And then he comes to me years after that and says, why don't you just buy me out? Here's the deal I want to make you. We sat down 12 bullet points later, done deal. And, he was paid out over time and, we went on. So the firm then became, Armel, Bennett, Gold, Berg, and Watson, then Armel, Bennett, Gold, and Berg, then Armel, Bennett, Gold, then Bennett, Gold. That's how it evolved with all those guys. But I'll tell you something. If I go back to my founding of my father's firm, I can trace the roots of this firm to 1929, moving in on 100 years of effectively a local family-owned CPA firm because my dad started with his uncle and took over his practice. And I took over my dad's practice, took over the Bennett practice. It's just a natural evolution of a local professional services firm. We're almost the last man standing of all of my peers. Now, some have retired, obviously, but most of the guys that built firms or joined firms like ours and grew them did deals with other firms. There's not that many firms like us, like Bennett Gold in Toronto, that has these kind of roots, almost 100 years of public accounting services in Toronto. Like, I want to get a plaque. I want to get like a key to the city. So that's an interesting route, right? It's an interesting route because look at the deaths. My dad's death, my partner's death, the retirement, and Donald passed away, unfortunately, a couple of summers ago. But it was the two deaths of my dad and then the mean partner, him dying like, whoa, sad for his family. But Donald and I worked out perfect. I mean, his family was taken care of. Too bad Harry, we didn't like you anyway. But Donald and I had a business to carry on, and we didn't lose any of the Harry clients because we all knew each other's clients to make sure that something like that happened. The client base is always protected, right? You got to keep your income flow. You got your employees. You want to, you don't want to shrink a practice. That's for sure. It's a good story, eh? But those are how accounting.
That's a killer story. So the question I want to—I feel like you kind of answered it, but it's kind of like, well, how? Like, look, these partners and this evolution. I want to ask you for a methodology, but the impression I'm getting is like, you correct me if I'm off base here. Be a good person, transferable trust, but also like a little bit of luck, right? I mean, because there's definitely some luck in there where it's like, look, that Harry story could have gone a completely different direction. Oh. And sure, you'd plan for all the directions, but look, who knows how rogue it could or couldn't have done, oh, it right? Would have been,
you want, I'll tell you how, if Harry had lived, how rogue it would have gone. At one point, Harry hired his son, who, I don't want to say a wayward youth, had a university degree, but was somewhat incorrigible. And all of a sudden, Harry brings him into the office. His name is Ian. Harry brings Ian into the office. Harry and Ian don't have decent conversations. It's kind of like if every conversation you had with your dad was an argument, to the point that in the office, you pass each other in the hall, each look different ways, right? They don't look at each other. Harry came to me and said, I gave Ian a job. He's your responsibility. What? What? I'm not a yeller. I will tell you, the only person I ever had a yelling argument with in my office was this guy, Ian. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Harry sticks in with me. When Harry died.
Interesting.
That was Ian's last day. I didn't have to fire him. He just left. He was only there because his dad told him to be there. His dad always felt he was Ian's bank.
You
want to hear something else? A little, an interesting story. Dictating from the grave. In Harry's will, he left most of his estate, which was good size. He had some real estate with his brothers for back then. He left most of his estate to his son and his children and future children. Left almost nothing to his daughter. Almost nothing. Complete, and this all came from a will that wasn't, nobody had knowledge of until after Harry died. He'd seen his brother so many times, brother was a lawyer, he'd seen his brother so many times to rewrite his will that Murray, Harry's brother, Murray said, Harry, I can't do this anymore. I'm passing you on to my partner. Good luck with your will. And he got it done, and he dictated from the grave what would happen for years after. The son was paid a management fee by the estate, plus got the wealth. The daughter got a one-time small payout. I don't know how you do that and bring the siblings apart, right? I've got some horror stories even in my extended family, his current history with siblings being put against each other, mothers being put in the middle because dad didn't give things forethought. The accountants and lawyers wrote up a tax plan without thinking about the effects on four siblings and the mom. And just, sure, this works, sir. Economically, this is your best bet. Yeah, but what about the effect on the children after you die when you don't treat them fairly or to give them an option to even up between themselves? Anyway, that's just nuts. And I saw that personally with Harry with his son and daughter. And I liked the daughter, hated the son. So
yeah,
you see these personal stories, right? I see personal stories in all of my clients. I'm sure in your business, you understand what is behind, what's behind the person, right? You have to.
Yeah. That's interesting. And was there any sort of buyout component? I'm more just curious, I guess. You'd mentioned that they left each other the.
When my dad died, I had his practice appraised. It was appraised low because it was a small practice in the basement of a house. Didn't have a lot of market value in theory, but my dad owed a small amount of income tax. So I bought his practice in theory from the income tax department for whatever that balance of tax was, and then there was no claim against it. He didn't have any other creditors I had to concern myself with, and I wasn't stealing from my mother. My brother's wife felt that I was stealing from my brother because it was my dad's practice, but he wasn't qualified to practice yet. If it wasn't me, the practice would have been gone. So I accommodated him by coming into the practice later on if he wanted to, and nothing I could do about the wife. My brother ultimately left our practice because it was too many internal pressures from his wife on him. How come he's not equal to me, even though I was saved the other practice, did this deal with these guys. You're here because of me, and this was hard for her for whatever reason. Really had nothing to do with me. Anyway, my brother went on to be a CPA in what he called the cultural industries, which was entertainment. So music and performers coming to Canada from the U.S. or anywhere, there's a tax thing. Canadian performers going to the U.S. as Ryan Reynolds or Gosling or whichever one's Canadian, or Jim Carrey, they've got cross-border tax issues. My brother handled their Canadian stuff and did financial management for a couple of small tours that went through. So he went on to enjoy what he wanted to do, and he retired a couple of years ago. And not me, though. I'm still fighting the good fight because I think entrepreneurs need help, and I can help them just because I can share the information. The accounting firm can do what the accounting firm does, but there's so much information to be shared with entrepreneurs. So much. I have a great LinkedIn almost daily post, which is all entrepreneur focused. If you go to my LinkedIn and just take a look at the post and just go backwards, I used to have a podcast called The Business of Beer podcast, which I did with a beer person. It's a whole other story, which I don't want to go sideways on that unless you ask me to. But I've lately been taking the transcripts from the Business of Beer podcast and turning the transcripts into a LinkedIn post by thinking about it using some AI tools. And they are so popular. When I tell a craft beer entrepreneur story and how you can learn from that, whoa, there's something about craft beer that gets your impressions and likes up on LinkedIn posts. I can't believe it. It's like, hi, I've got some pretty good ones in there, but it's craft beer. I'm going to run out of episodes soon. There's only six or eight episodes, so I won't be able to do that many. But then craft beer ones are great entrepreneur stories, great stories with lessons to share. And that's the goal, eh? The goal is always to share the lessons from. If you and I sit down for 2 hours, I get to do my accountant hat, entrepreneur probing thing. There's a million lessons that'll come out of that conversation that you can share with me and I can share with you. Entrepreneurs have to learn from each other. I was a director of a group called YEA, the Young Entrepreneurs Association, which generally met younger people first time in business. So under 30, under 35, something like that. They learned more, not from the panelists that we brought to the monthly meetings. They learned more from the discussions with each other. Entrepreneurs learn from entrepreneurs. Hey, I got this problem. Do you know anybody that can help me with? Not a plumber, but like, I got an HR problem. This person's asking for this. How do I deal with this behavior? How about this client or this customer wants to return, you know, $100,000 worth of what? How do I deal with this? What's the language? You have someone I can turn to. Entrepreneurs help entrepreneurs. It's like the greatest lesson I can share. I really advise every company, have an advisory board. Get other entrepreneurs that you pay with a dinner once a month or something, six or eight that you can count on, so at least four or five will show up. Sit around the table every month or two with your, open up your book, pull up your notes. Issues du jour, like what are my big problems today? What's the longer, since I last saw you 2 months ago, this has come up. I want some input. Have other entrepreneurs, have your uncle, the one that runs a drugstore, or anybody that's been in business. There's only a few business stories. As you start a business, you hire people, you fire people, you get a client, you lose a client, you have a partnership, and you go to five or six more. That's it. Everybody in business has the same stories, just over and over again, depending on the cycle where you are. And once you think you finish a story, like you've hired somebody successful, I hired a guy to replace somebody that was with me for like 40 years. It took me the whole summer to find this guy through a recruiter. Finally find the right guy. He's 29 years old, got the right background, can fill the role. Comes to me after 7 weeks, Sam, and he says, my fiance of a couple of years has left me and I'm quitting work. How do you connect those two dots? She left me, I'm quitting work. So I spoke to him like his father would speak to him, and he came to me the next morning and he said, okay, thought about what you said. I don't want to be looking at this in 6 months down the road, realize I made the biggest mistake of my life, so I'm not going to leave. Okay, dodged the bullet. Sam, 3 weeks later, he quit. I've only now just replaced him. Like today, a guy accepted my offer. I dodged a bullet with the guy that quit because clearly there's a screw loose somewhere, and this guy that's coming in, I got him. He's available in the marketplace because the firm he's with, three partner CPA firm, two of them embezzled $550,000 from two clients. They're being forced to close the door. They're closing down January 15th. This guy's in the marketplace, exactly what I need, someone like that in the marketplace. How do these stars align? Like, how do they align? You stay in business long enough, everything happens to you. Everything.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's something almost religious or destined, like to your point about the stars align and the way of connecting. And I don't know, I believe in a higher power for sure. But it's interesting, too. I wanted to take a moment. There's actually an organization I'm a part of. I feel like it would be rude at this point if I didn't shout them out. So in the US, we had YEO, Young Entrepreneurs Organization. They yep. evolved into EO, the Entrepreneurs yep. Organization, and they do exactly what you're talking about. And my one of my favorite aspects, one of the key selling points to me of the organization was, this attributes to my learning style, is you're not allowed to give advice. They reframe it. They say you're allowed to, you can speak from experience. You're not allowed to give advice. And the key difference there is, you know, great example, you know, I'm sitting down with you. Maybe I'm talking about some sort of like financial thing, right? And yours is probably, I mean, you've got plenty of opportunities for advice. So that's maybe not a great example, but normally some other person, right, might want to say, oh, this is exactly how you should do it. But that assumes they know my business, right?
That's right.
And really nobody knows my business, but mine. It's, you know, if we're from a mind your business aspect, I like to think I do an all right job of it. But you can say, here's a scenario where I had maybe something similar, or I'm familiar with something having happened similar, and here's what they did in that scenario. And it's fascinating to me how this is a bit that I found a little bit wild, because I joined relatively recently. I'm like 6 months or so in. What I've found super interesting is when you get a room of people that like, oh, here's what I did, here's how I think, here's how I think. What I end up hearing by the end of it, I swear my own voice has this internal monologue that by the end of it is like, this is exactly what you should do. And it may not be anything they said, but somehow just their combined experience creates this internal, this is your right answer, Sam. This is your business and what it needs to do.
Oh, I agree. Internalization is everything. You making quick decisions, instinctual, may work some percentage of the time. But I mean, I'm guilty of this. I jump at things. I lose interest in things. I move to the next thing. But if you slow down and you just let me sleep on that, you may or may not wake up in the middle of the night and write something down on a post-it note. But to the next day, your thinking will have additional kind of clarity. Your mind is doing things at night that, and we don't understand those electrons and synapses firing. They're not all sleeping, right? There's some electric charge going on. And it is no question in my mind that my better ideals are clarified by the next morning. Whether it's in the shower, I'm doing a couple of emails, boom, you know, oh yeah, that's a better idea. And don't you find that you create most of your ideas that you might take to business partners or to clients, you create the germ of the idea, you're on your own. You're on your own. And then something develops, some, and then you need to bring other people in if it's serious. But like ideas pop into your head, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, all the time. I laugh at people. My full-time job is smothering them.
maybe you ought to just go to hovering them. Just become a hover type of thing, right? A helicopter parent, isn't that what that is? Yeah, a helicopter. Yeah. Don't smother them, hover them.
Yeah, yeah. So, is Don, did I ask this yet? Is Don still, Don Bennett, is he still around? Is he retired?
He passed away a couple of years. He actually retired at 85. Should have retired 10 years earlier, but it was easy for me to have around and expensive to take out until he was really ready to go. And then he made me an offer that was like, you couldn't refuse. It was just like, okay, great. Let's do this. What, you know, tomorrow kind of thing. So it worked out well.
With
family. I had an insurance policy on him that he and I split the cost of, and the insurance policy ultimately, because of my partnership deal with him, would pay me back 50% of whatever I paid for his practice at that time. It was there was a payout over a number of years, and depending where I was, payout. So ultimately, it lives to be paid out completely. I got paid off the whole debt. He didn't die before that fifth year. He died afterwards, so I got half of my 5 years worth of payments, and his two sons got the other half. And we had an insurance trust between myself and the boys, so they wouldn't feel I would scam with the money. And, you know, one of his sons is a lawyer, he's a litigator, so you can be sure it was papered properly because he was a lawyer.
There's something to be said about attorneys and having it done proper. I swear, it's interesting. I don't know. My experience with attorneys is like, if you've got one involved on either end of the deal, you could be best that when you look at that paperwork, it's going to be like, this is exactly what we talked about. Both sides on paper. Well, that's fantastic. I should sign now. you know. So
you got to, if business, personal, I mean, I could lecture anybody on having prenups, but I've on my third wife and never had any prenups. So, you know, I can give all the advice in the world. It's not good advice. But when it comes to business agreements and family law stuff, if you find yourself, I'm on my wife three, right? I've dealt with family law. Anywhere where there's a potential for legal liability or financial loss, paper it. It's well worth it. Lawyers are well worth the money. Just find one that you like and trust and deal with a local lawyer, not a large law firm. Like, don't go downtown. I don't care what city you're in. Don't go downtown. Stay out of downtown. Stay away from the chain law firms and the downtown. It's not necessary. Find a business lawyer that you can communicate with, a family law lawyer you can communicate with. And go, if you're an entrepreneur type of person, like we're talking about, you want to deal with the entrepreneur accountants and the entrepreneur lawyers. They speak your language. That sounds like I've given this pitch before.
It does kind of, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It does. Yeah, well, again, you know, many businesses, same issues.
Yeah. Yep. 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 Man, I love my attorney. Cool. So, I feel like that's a pretty good spot to lead to my wrap up questions, but I do like to ask, you know, is there anything in particular you think we hardcore missed that just would have made a Don Gerd story to include?
Given that you allowed me to go on a lot of tangents from the mobile movie minute to web trust to a couple of, you know, well-timed deaths, like it's a, I appreciate
well,
that.
Well, we interlace them though. That's the, sometimes these don't, we try to. But I'll admit that they don't always, it was a well-curated story, I would say, Robert.
Well, I think you asked the questions in the right order. I noticed, Sam, you brought me back when I was like, we're down this web trust rabbit hole, and I'm in Tampa, Florida with these guys working for Peter. All of a sudden, you brought the story back. So well done as a one-on-one moderator. I don't know how you must have a list going, make sure we address these points.
Well, somehow it's just it's your story and you're writing it for me. And I kind of have these moments of sometimes the in any good story, right? The hero has a monologue and that we need that. It adds to it. But once it's done, also, you know, right back to, and that creates the great story, right? I mean, if chapter two was the exact same thing as chapter one, some of the better stories that engage me. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Now I'm going down a tangent. So here are the questions.
Yes,
so
sir.
I have two questions I like to wrap up in.
All right, number two.
We have a motto around here. If we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life, Robert Gold, that you would like to pay homage to?
I throw that to my dad, honestly, because I learned the interpersonal skill, which has made my career. It's all the ability to communicate with people at an honest and comfortable level. And I think I'm good at it. And I think when my staff sees how I communicate with clients, they don't know how to talk like this, right? They're accountants. They're more fact-based. Doesn't matter what their age is. I got people from their mid-20s to, you know, older than mid-20s. And unless you teach them the soft skills of communication, I'm working with accountants and this is hard for them. But to me, that stand on the shoulder of my dad, because that's the core skill set. We're communicating complex financial data to lay people. If you can do that and they sign that tax return, they'll tell you, they'll tell their friends. And I'm not a tax return salesman, but it's the analogy, right?
You said it, bring it down to the level. Speak to the person's level, your dad would say.
Exactly. And that's not disrespectful. It's respectful.
No, and I would agree. And I'll be honest, for me personally, even in topics where I understand a decent bit, even then, if I'm talking to a professional, I'll tell them, I'm like, you know those Four Dummies books? I used to love those books because they didn't ever assume knowledge. You could read the book, and by the end of it, you could be an expert and you'd start at stage one. Can you talk to me like you're writing one of those Four Dummies books, please?
I think one of the first Dummies books I bought was Podcasting for Dummies early on. So how do you set up a podcast? I got a computer. I got a, you know, I got crap mic. I ended up, Andrew and I had a Zoom mic that had a couple of steroid, good mics. It was, if they called them field mics at the time, because people would take them outdoors to record outdoor sounds and what have you, and or interviews in front of, you know, the White House. And we would set it up in a middle of the table at a coffee shop, and sound quality be damned, right? When we went to Starbucks, because we had an upstairs room at Starbucks, and there's a radio station in Toronto that is CFRB, and I had one of their mic triangle things, and it said CFRB, and I would stick this. We'd go upstairs, and people would see us, say, oh, they're recording a CFRB radio show. Starbucks in the summer, they sell a lot of ice milkshake kind of things, and they throw the ice cubes in the mixer, and we're trying to do a podcast, and this thing goes off. It's like, oh my God, drove me crazy, because I used to edit them originally in GarageBand, and then we hired an editor to help us out with that. We had to get out of the Starbucks, but the bagel restaurant, we even had theme music. It would start off with from a bagel restaurant somewhere in Toronto, and the jingle was fun, but it was all like just get out in the field, right? Talk to people.
That's beautiful. So the second question is, if you had a pithy saying or general statement that you found to be true in your life again and again and again, what would it be?
Can I quote Yoda? Because I say this all the time. Do or do not. There is no try. Oh, that's my pithy statement. And I can't think of a better one. So I have to give it to Yoda. But, you know, the thing that people would attribute to me is always just move forward. You got to move forward. Everything you do, putting personal stuff somewhere, you got to move forward. Three wives, you got to move forward. But in business, you got to make decisions, and you can't keep second guessing yourself. One of the presentations I do about entrepreneurship to these incoming is why businesses succeed or fail by year two. And we talk about why, how hard it is to make a decision. And if you're waiting to get to 90% to be sure you're making the right decision, you've waited too long. It takes too long to get to 90%. Make a decision at 70, 80%. Get to a comfort level. Like, be critical of your thinking, but make the freaking decision. In Canada, I learned a long time ago, our business decisions make this, our decision makers, government, particularly in business, make decisions at 50% of the speed that y'all in America make decisions. You guys make fast entrepreneur business decisions. We do not. That's part of our productivity issue. We could speed everything up if we would just make decisions at 75%, not wait for 90%. That's another presentation you should come up with. Make that decision today. How to make that decision today. Buy that book now.
That's good. Well, to that end, you should plug your book, by the way, because I don't know if we've done it yet on air. Now's your opportunity to talk about that.
So Andrew Brown, who was a co-host of mine on the BusinessCast podcast, he and I wrote this book, Business Truths. You can find it's at Amazon. You can find it. If you know me and send me your email address, you get it for free. I'll just send it to you. If you go to Amazon to buy it, I guess it might be $10 or so. I don't know. That's where I would go, Amazon. And it tells business stories from the perspective of, I think there's 30 or 40 podcast interviews where we gleaned the stories and told that particular story. So it's business stories, 1.5, 2 pages each based on the podcast. And we came up with, in the stories, 96 proven ways to build loyalty, grow profits, and succeed at everything in between. Business truths. So I don't care if you buy it or you don't buy it, but Andrew and I had fun doing it. It's based on podcast interviews that we did, the Business Cast. The Business Cast evolved to be associated with a couple of different universities. We became Business Cast powered by DMZ, which was the digital media zone at what is now Toronto Metropolitan University. It renamed from Ryerson University because Mr. Ryerson had some bad dealings in the past, so we renamed the university that he founded. Sorry, bud, but, you know, you shouldn't have bad dealings. And so that's a digital media zone was there. Then we became part of the Profit Business Cast, or became the Profit Magazine, was a Canadian business magazine, a subset of a larger one called Canadian Business. And we became the Profit Business Cast. So it's had a number of renditions. I would just find different platforms. I wanted to do the interviews. I didn't want to bother with the hosting of the technology. I will deliver a finished produced MP3. You guys host it on an agreed to schedule. I'll promote it and I'll take care of, here's your episode, right? Just in the camp. So yeah, so Business Cast lived a lot, 700 episodes. Did a lot. Weekly. We're doing them weekly. Weekly business interviews. Andrew and I would figure out the questions in advance. One of my favorite questions that I used to leave authors with was, and I think Andrew created this question, what did you learn from writing this book that you didn't think you'd learn? What a great question for authors. So if you interview an author, what did you learn that you didn't think you'd learn from their own book?
What did you learn that you didn't think you'd learn? Wow.
Yeah, from writing the book. Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah.
I got to ask, what did you learn in business truths that you didn't think you were going to learn?
Huh.
That's such a good question. Shout out to Andrew. Man, yeah. That's deep.
You know what I learned? It's not that hard to do a self-published book, get it on Amazon, get all the barcodes, get all the stuff. I learned that anybody can do a self-published book. And now with AI, throw it into any one of the AI tools, have it produced chapter by chapter, edit it so it's your voice, not, chat voice. Self-publish a book. Like, everybody's got experience. If you're in business, you can tell a story about the worst hiring experience. Just talk, put the transcript in, deep dive into your own transcript. Everything that we're doing today that you're recording, we could dump into ChatGPT, here's the transcript, and query it about the facts and the issues that came out of today. I had an interview with a new client today, recorded the interview. I didn't know what the conversation was going to be about. It was introduced to me by a family member. The principal works out. They've got tax issues. They're overpaying for professional services. They have companies hanging around they don't need. I took our transcript, dumped the transcript into ChatGPT, and said to it, okay, summarize. You can use Fireflies to create the notes. But when you go into, say, with the transcript to Chat or Gemini and get into a dialogue with the robot, what are the key issues from this meeting? What did I suggest? One of the things that we have as a big issue that came out of that 1 hour meeting, which has promoted a proper second meeting, not a discovery call, was something called personal service corporations, where they attract a lot of tax if you do it wrong, or if you do it at all, be aware. I go into ChatGPT, extract the issues that were raised and the comments made on personal service corporations, give me links to the Canada Revenue Agency, the CRA's pages, give me links to an authoritative commentary on this subject from lawyers, and give me the sources. Now I can create a memo specific to that issue for the client, for my staff, for follow-up. Here's the sources. If people were deep diving into their own recorded conversations, it's unbelievable what you could do. Deep dive into recordings you make when you're interviewing people for, say, look, I'm using an AI tool. I'm recording this for we can, do our own work later on. And you deep dive on your own transcripts of some of your potential candidates you might be hiring. It's unbelievable. You could ask it to assess it 8 out of 10. I just went through that, coming up with the questions on my own. I ended up in the end, as a result of all that, with a successful hire. He's suited for us. We made the decision anyway, but the tool gives you so much more. I've got a coaching guide for this guy based on what he told us, what we came up with in a couple of hours with the conversations and his resume. Here's your coaching guide for the next 12 months, step by step. The things that you said were important to you, here's how we're addressing them. Here's the steps you should take. All out of the transcripts of dialogues the two of us had. These tools we know are amazing. People need to think more creatively how they can use the tool now for themselves in their business. And although I think it's creepy that every conversation be recorded, it's really helpful in business. It's really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. 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 I'll say, you and I can talk a little bit afterwards. I say we wrap it up here. Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Okay, Sam, and everyone out there, check the Craft Brewery LinkedIn posts on my Robert Gold LinkedIn. They're great little stories. And then go back and read the other, learn. It's all there to educate, to help. I want success. Success for you guys.
Love it. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you, Sam. I had fun. My voice is harsh now.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube,
Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.